Welcome to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between, or DH&I. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to our podcast about the relevance of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to our episode on It by Stephen King. Probably, I would say, the most anticipated episode of the Horrifying Classics series this year. I'm super excited to dive into everything with you guys, as I'm sure you all are as well. This is episode 1 of 2, so after you get done listening to this episode, go right along to the second part, which is an unabridged interview that I did with my childhood friend Jason Freeman. We both ended up seeing both parts of the movies last year and this year actually together, and I had some questions about what he thought, especially about the horror aspect of both of the movies. And in it, I also divulged some of the more specific comments that I can't get to in this episode from the book. So if you want a little more specificity, definitely check out the interview. In terms of readability, this is the longest book of the series, and I think that is part of why it is so looked out for this year in Horrifying Classics, is because no one wants to read it, they just want to see how it is, which I totally understand. The average paperback is about 1,350 pages, with the most popular audiobook version from Audible being 44 hours long. I actually listened to the audiobook at 1.5 to 2 times the speed. The actual diction of the narrator, Steven Weber, he's amazing. He's an incredible reader. I respect him a lot, and I've listened to the equivalent of 44 hours of his voice since I did read the audiobook version. I respect, again, his talent for reading a lot and his imagination. I think he brings a lot to bringing the text to life, and I do say that he speeds up really well, and this is a trend that I find among really respected and good, just good audiobook readers, is people who can have their voice at multiple speeds, and that might also play a role with the editing of the audiobook, but generally Audible's audiobooks, especially this one by Steven Weber, with It and other works by Stephen King, read fairly well. So if you are really daunted by the fact that it's 1,350 pages on average, I would go for the audiobook. I really enjoyed it. I do have to say that even though I listened to it almost double the speed, or at some points double the speed, and that does take a lot of getting used to, by the way, it took about 3 months of daily listening. In my everyday life, I just listened to an audiobook literally whenever I could. Every time I would go walking outside, every time I did the laundry, dishes, chores, what have you, I would listen to this audiobook, and it still took me 3 months to get through. There's just so much nuance and rich detail and little tricks and things that King does, and he has ample time, as I'm sure you can imagine, to put these kinds of things into the book. So it is worth the 1,300 pages of reading, but I would recommend doing the reading in a way that is most accessible and most available for your lifestyle. So if you do have an hour to put in with reading a physical book every day, and you want to put away your other subject reading, for example, I'm reading a biography of Adorno right now, and I wasn't willing, in other words, to put Adorno away for it, then I would recommend it if you could fork up the time and the mental energy. But otherwise, I would really recommend the audiobook. Quick summary of it. This is also a really popular book, just like last week's work, so this will be quick 1 minute summary, maybe 30 seconds. In Derry, Maine, there is this group of children. It's 7 in the beginning, and then when they return as adults, it's actually 6. But the story is that every 27 years, a spree of murders hits Derry, and it's all children, right? So there's between 15 and 35 murders, somewhere thereabouts, in this small town, and never gains any media attraction, never gains any real suspicion or superstition with the locals. They set a curfew for children, tell them not to go out alone, those kinds of things, but they really don't treat the murders like you should treat a murder, and there's a lot of different suspenseful elements in regards to how the town treats the murders, how the world treats the murders, and as well, what the children see when they're out on the town, especially when they're alone. So there is this clown figure that will often show up, for example, in the very beginning of the book. It's exactly the same as the beginning of the movie, but Bill Dunbar's little brother, Georgie, is in the rain. He's playing with his little boat that they've waterproofed, and he sees this clown in the storm drain when his boat gets flushed down the storm drain. And the clown, you know, dismembers him and eats him eventually, but it is a lot about the imagery and the suspense and the really the picture that the clown can conjure within the children's minds. And this is something that that adults, for the most part, don't seem to pick up on in Derry. And so there's this presence who often appears in this embodiment of the clown, but really is, in the book, the clown is a werewolf, a mummy, a vampire, Frankenstein, all of these different iterations of people's worst fears. And that fear and that image seems only to work itself in the minds of children. So there's this presence in Derry, there's murders, and it comes back every 27 years. Well, in the summer of 1957, or thereabouts, 1958, group of kids, seven kids, stop the presence of it in its tracks, because at the end of every 27-year cycle, there's a bunch of murders and then a huge event. Like, for example, in the early 1900s, there was this huge fire at what was called the Black Spot, killing numerous amounts of people, including adults. And then there was explosions at the ironworks and mill explosions and things like this. So there's huge events, and that huge event didn't seem to happen in 1957-58 because of the children's intervention. However, in the mid-1980s, 85 or so, the presence comes back again and children start getting murdered again. So Mike Hamlin, who is one of the children, now an adult, he's the librarian of Derry now, he essentially assembles what's left of the team, which is six people now, because Stan Uris, the Jewish character in the book, and one of the kids commits suicide when he gets Mike Hamlin's call. So they assembled six, and they face down with it for a second time, and beloved characters from their childhood, beloved events actually as well from their childhood, such as the little treehouse, or rather underground treehouse, that Ben really orchestrates comes back, and different little nuances, as well characters such as Henry Bowers, Victor, and Patrick, they all come back, the bullies, to really replicate this really spooky energy in Derry that recurs when everyone comes back for the 27th reunion of this event. So really it's two parts, the adults and the children. I'll get into some cool things about the book now. So cool things about the book are really how the book is written. So the book is written from the perspective of the adults. So the entire book, though it starts out with Georgie's murder and a few other mysterious happenings in Derry, it literally, right after that, launches into recounts of the adults and their experiences, getting Mike Hamlin's phone calls, their experiences leaving. For example, Beverly Marsh, she has to escape her extremely violent husband, and there's this huge scenario that goes along with that. Backstory, Bill Denbrough, he's married to this famous actress, and he has to leave her and explain things to her, and he no longer stutters, for instance, and he starts stuttering again, has to sort of explain those sorts of things. And also later in the book, since really the adulthood is the primary cusp of the story, we don't really get much from the childhood bits early on. A lot of these spouses and things, the people start coming back to Derry, essentially to find, for example, Bill's wife comes and Beverly's husband starts to come as well. So all of those things really are the major motivating actions of the book. Then we have the part about the children, which is the second part. So oftentimes they will remember things from their childhood because of things that they're living now. There's a really interesting lapse, a collective lapse of memory from 27 years ago. So they remember each other, sort of, but they are really in pursuit of memory for most of the book. And they're in pursuit of how they were able to approach the monster as children, approach of their fears as well, and how those fears helped them, hurted them in their journey during that one summer. Another cool thing about the book is that the chapters are not linear at all, jumps around a lot, and he'll actually cut off in the middle of a word or cut off in the middle of the sentence to end the chapter, and then continue that sentence in another chapter later in the book. So this happens especially near the end of the book. I'd say the last 8 hours or so of the audiobook, you get a lot of this fragmentation. And I liked that a lot in my experience reading. It does keep you on your toes quite a bit because it adds to the quickening of King's pace as he's getting towards the end of the book. Interestingly enough, unlike in the movies as well, we don't understand what this battle, final face-off with it, really is going to look like or was or did look like until literally the last hour of the book. So he does get into some broad details in terms of, I know that, for instance, early on in the book, they talk about how that they fought it, but none of those details are revealed until the very end, and that's aided, those events are aided by the pacing. And one of the things that he does to aid the pacing is, of course, the abrupt language and the more frequent switches between past and present. We already talked about a bit of the faces of it. He's not always a clown, and that is one of the things that I am sort of disappointed retrospectively in the movies for, that he was just steadily a clown in the movies, but really has a lot of different interesting guises, including at one point leeches in this refrigerator. And I understand that perhaps a lot of the nuance of the book had to have been dropped just because of the sheer length of it. I mean, you couldn't really encapsulate everything in the book, in this series, or in a series of movies, but I did lose a little bit out of the faces of it, and knowing that it wasn't just a clown, that it wasn't just this sort of ironic character, it was more than that, and it was a lot about the embodiment of fear. And I would also just say the suspense of the final face-off, I don't want to belabor this point necessarily, but again, we just really don't know about the final face-off until the end of the book, and I think because this book is so long, that suspense is really beautiful that King is able to create. One of the questions that I've gotten about reading the book is, do you ever get bored in the book? I know a lot of people who've read the book 1Q84 by Haruki Murakami. I have not reviewed that on this channel. If you'd like a review, leave a comment in the blog on this episode. I will, but I liked 1Q84 to the extent that I like Haruki Murakami. It's a meditational book in its own right, and it's a masterwork in its own right. However, I do think that Murakami, in terms of his diction and style, is better taken in small doses and therefore gets stale over a longer period, such as in 1Q84. I believe that's around 1,700 pages, if I'm not mistaken. But I didn't get bored with it. And I think part of it was this narration by Steven Weber. But the other reason why is I think that the narrative is just crafted better. It's more of a story rather than a concept. And I think in 1Q84, it's more about the art of the book rather than the art of this story that they're trying to tell. And ultimately, stories are more entertaining than face value, just art for art's sake. And I think there is value in both, obviously. 1Q84... save for the ending, I don't want to give anything away, but save for the ending, I thought was just a gorgeous piece of art. And in a similar vein, I think it is just a gorgeous story. So, getting into our questions. Is King a regionalist writer? Yes. I have to conclude with just a blanket yes. King is the epitome of a regionalist. We will be reviewing and going back to King later in our podcast, probably next year, not for horrifying classics, but probably just during the year. I want to review some of his more recent literature and talk about this more, but he really is the definition of a regionalist. I'm actually now questioning if Joan Didion is a true regionalist, because as I've been going through her books, and you all have challenged me to finish her books by the end of the year, which I'm trying my best to do, but I've been reading Miami and Salvador lately. I finished Salvador a few weeks ago, finishing Miami probably by the end of this week. And those really make me question whether or not she truly is a regionalist, whether she truly writes about California and New York in a way that is unique from the way she writes about Salvador, Miami, places like this. And so yeah, aside from that questioning though, that questioning stems from the fact that I just think King is such a substantially constant regionalist that if he's the norm or the ideal here, then Didion may be far off the mark, especially in terms of her earlier work. Second question, can we map out King's work thematically, regionally, by timeline anyway? And my answer to this question is no. We cannot. That is because I believe ultimately that authors' works, especially over a lifetime, are just far too complex for people to be able to do that, unless we have a long gap of essentially hindsight produced by history. And what I mean by this is really when I set out to ask this question, I did it in true earnest, because I'd never thought about mapping someone's work thematically out before, and I thought maybe it could be done, especially in terms of maybe the themes like guilt or innocence or love or fear that the author might introduce over their career. But I really think that there's no way to determine exactly what the author especially was thinking when they writing this. And if we have a great distance, like for example with Dostoevsky, we can more easily say, we don't have our hands as tightly bound behind our backs, we can more easily say, for example, okay, Dostoevsky was in prison during this period. This is totally a fake example, but okay, Dostoevsky was in prison during this period, maybe he was thinking about innocence and guilt because of the fact that he was in prison, or something like this, where we have enough distance from it to be able to have a colder shoulder to an analysis of an author's work thematically. And my bonus question before the bonus episode that you should all listen to as well, for this episode, the end of Horrifying Classics, I can't believe it, is, am I a fan of Stephen King's work? And this question I ask because people have asked me, oh, you're reviewing Stephen King this year, very popular author, more of a mainstream pop culture author, especially earlier in the 80s and 90s. What do you think of his work? Because I'm more of a straight path literature person, if you're new to the show and don't know really what I usually review, this is very atypical for me. And I'd say, yeah, I am a fan. I talked about how I'm planning on reviewing more of his work. I'm interested to see, especially modern work of his, how that plays out. And yeah, I would say he just crafts such beautiful stories. And I can't believe that it took me 19 years to be able to stumble upon these stories, because I do believe there's a lot of value in them. And I do believe that I have found a lot of enjoyment from them in the past few months of preparing for this series. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there's a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our brand new website, relevanceofliterature.com, for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. You can also follow us on Twitter or join our Facebook group. Our handle is @DidianIn, 2 N's total for both of those. And finally, if you want to support the show, help keep it ad-free, and get access to our new private podcast, go to patreon.com/relevanceofliterature and sign up to become a sponsor. All of the relevant links, as always, are in the description box down below. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!